Starting up a business is hard, really, really hard. Your chances of failure are high. You're likely to lose both your sleep and your hair. But luckily for you, you're not alone. Welcome to ET Startup School, your step-by-step guide to starting, building and consolidating your startup business idea. Your teachers at the ET Startup School will be some of India's best-known entrepreneurs, VCs and domain experts. So grab a notebook, pay close attention, school is about to start. Today's class at ET Startup School is called How Do I Course Correct? Course correction, as you may already know, is a term borrowed from the age of sailing ships. And to help you understand how to steer your startup ship out of troubled waters, your teacher is Mayank Kumar, co-founder of EdTech unicorn UpGrad. Like most startups, UpGrad's road to becoming a unicorn was not without challenges. One of those challenges is what's being called the funding winter that's currently underway. Money is tight, investors are scarce, runways have shortened. So what do you need to do to keep your business afloat? Listen on and find out. Mayank Kumar of UpGrad, welcome to ET Startup School.
Thanks, Suresh. Thanks for having me here today.
Your class is called How Do I Course Correct? Now, you founded UpGrad in 2014 with Ronnie Skruvala, Falgun Kompally, and Ravijot Chugh. What did you look for in your co-founders when you founded UpGrad?
No, I think good question. So we started in 2015, when we started UpGrad, for me, when you're looking at co-founders, I mean, for me, it was very simple, Suresh, that I tend to look for things that I'm not good at. So for me, that complementarity of skills matters a lot more. So if I'm good at something, I will look for my co-founder to be good at something which I'm not good at. And I think that's the reason why I feel every entrepreneur who's starting up or who's already in the journey need to be very self-aware. And not live in a different world altogether. Know what their strengths are, know what their weaknesses are, and just try to supplement your weaknesses with the co-founder that you bring on board.
Okay, so what are you not good at?
I think many things. The list is endless. So I don't think that the list will get over in today's conversation. But look, I mean, for me, it was very clear that I understand education really well. I can navigate through the problems that the education sector provides. But I have not built a scale company. I have never scaled up the business. I have not been in an ecosystem where I've operated at scale. So Ronnie, for me, as my co-founder, brought in that understanding really strongly. I'm a great problem solver, and I can sit down and sort of look for a solution and come back with an answer. But I've never led a large team. My co-founder, Falgun, was a naturally born people leader. So for me, when I'm looking at co-founders, I was looking at things wherein I can bring in complementarity skill set. I did not come from tech background, Suresh, so technology was not my forte. So my co-founder Ravi brought in that into the mix. Knowing what you're good at and just accepting what you're not good at is one of the starting point of a founder. And if you can take that properly, and then you can build your founding team and the co-founders in the right manner.
In a nutshell, Mayank, what is the essence of UpGrad's business model?
In the current context, Suresh, every individual today is going through massive level of skill obsolescence. Today you know something, tomorrow you don't know anything, and because of the skill sets changing very, very rapidly. So we believe in one mantra that education cannot be a one-time event in your life. It is a continuous process, and you need to keep on learning on an ongoing basis. The single essence, the single mantra is, you will need to learn on an ongoing basis. And therefore, like you have a banking partner, you have a telecom partner, you have an insurance partner, you need a career partner. And that career partner and that learning partner is what UpGrad is.
All right. And essentially, people come and learn from UpGrad and they pay you a fee. Is that the model?
Yeah. So they come, they pay us a fee, they learn from UpGrad. But once they finish learning, we have a very strong alumni pool. Where we engage with alumni with multiple initiatives free of cost, because we know that after finishing the program, maybe 3 years later, 5 years later, 10 years later, they will come back to us again. So we believe that in the mantra of lifelong learning, we believe that if you have a bank, you work with that bank. If you have an education or a career need or the learning need, you work with that career or the learning partner. And therefore, for us, not just the learning after paying the fees is important, but what we do with the learners after they complete the program is equally important.
The title of today's episode is called How Do I Course Correct? Course correction, of course, is a term that's been borrowed from the shipping industry when ships tended to go off course. So Mayank, how do you tell if your startup is beginning to go off course? What are the early warning signs?
it's a complicated topic. It's a tough topic. When Suresh, you ask somebody that, look, what are the sort of telltale signs as to when you need to course correct? See, you may not have one single answer, but there are multiple things that actually you start seeing as trends. You may see this in attrition rates. You may suddenly see that a lot of your employees are leaving at different points in time. You may see this in NPS dropping, that something in the ecosystem, there's a strong drop in the NPS play.
Net promoter score.
Yes, correct.
Is the score of people recommending your brand to other people, in effect.
Correct, yeah. So essentially how happy the customers are or the consumers are for your product and how likely are they to recommend you. And if you see that score dropping, you know that something wrong is happening. You start seeing these trends in certain key business metrics, i.e. retention rate. So you got a set of customer. How many are you able to retain after 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 10 months? So I think those are certain operating metrics that as a founder, as an individual, as a company that you need to keep track of. And not every business is exactly the same manner. So whatever the key metrics, you start seeing certain trends in those metrics, which will make you realize that, look, I'm doing something wrong. Because if my attrition was, let's say, 3%, 5% a month, and suddenly it has gone to 9% a month, I'm doing something wrong at that point of time. If my sort of net promoter score was operating at 70 out of 100, and suddenly I'm seeing a 50 or 40 out of 100, I'm doing something wrong. These lead indicators, Suresh, actually start reflecting on P&L indicators or profit and loss statement and your unit economics in a slightly lag manner. You don't get to see these indicators. Financial indicators are slightly lag indicators to operating indicators. And you start seeing the same impact. If, let's say, your attritions are low, you would suddenly start seeing your cost of employees going up because people do not have that know-how and they take some time, so you have to hire more people. They're not as efficient as somebody who was with 12 months or 18 months into the system. You will start seeing the impact of a lower NPS scores in marketing costs going up. So I tell everybody that, look, first focus on your operating metric. Figure out what are the key operating metrics. If you see a significant change in that, you know that you need to course correct. If you do not course correct then and there, you will start seeing the impact on financial metric. And by the time it hits the financial metric, you are perhaps a month, 2 months, or a quarter delay in taking action on course correcting in your own business.
Okay, to use a shipping analogy again, this is looking at the iceberg from a distance versus knowing that you've just hit the iceberg. Your ship is slowly going to sink after a little while. It won't sink instantaneously.
Yeah, it won't sink instantaneously. And that's a downfall. That's where the downfall starts.
How many times have you pivoted since you started in 2015?
So I think from a strategy perspective, we are very clear as to what we want to do. But in a tactical and operating manner, I may not be able to give you the number, but I think every month and every quarter, there is something course correction that one needs to do. Given the fact that, look, I mean, you also have to see the industry, Suresh, as to where each of the industries are.
Just to interrupt you, these could be minor course corrections, right? They could be slight. They're not dramatic course corrections.
No, they're not dramatic course corrections.
West or east or north or south.
Yeah, there's a dramatic course correction. I think from a strategic perspective, we have been very clear in the path that we have chosen. And we know what the pieces of puzzle that we want to prove and then sort of get to. There will be certain major course corrections. There will be certain minor course correction. But I think course correction is the nature of the business. And then you do need to sort of take some of these calls over a period of time. But if I have to just take up some of the key ones in our journey, I think the first one I would mention is when we first launched our program, Suresh, one of our first program was on entrepreneurship. We said that, look, I was doing VC earlier, VC investments earlier, venture capital investment, and Ronnie was in the startup space for quite some time. Falgun, Ravi, all of us understood startups really well. We thought that we can teach entrepreneurship and we can build a program on entrepreneurship. And the program really did well. But then we realized, Suresh, that over a period of time, the cost of acquiring a customer started getting very expensive. And that was a slightly lag indicator for us because people want to be entrepreneurs, but for you to find them at the right place at the right time to convince them for a program is an expensive proposition. So I think that's the time when we had to move away from entrepreneurship to other hard skills. And we moved to data science, digital marketing, product management, so on and so forth. I think that was one of the pivots that we did from talking about a topic which is massively relevant. But difficult to find customers And that was one sort of course correction we did, because hard skills, people understand, people get it very easily. Over a period of time, when we're doing hard skills, we realized that scaling beyond a certain threshold was getting challenging. If I have to go beyond, let's say, the first 100 crores of revenue, I was not able to breach the 100 crore mark. And to go beyond the 100 crore revenue mark, I realized that people are not just looking for certificates, they're looking for degrees. And degrees are perhaps from an Indian mindset and the Indian context, degrees are far more sort of valuable than just the hard skill. So I think we then added degrees in the overall sort of scheme of upgrade, sort of positioning, et cetera, and that just sort of was another course correction. I would call it course correction, or you sort of add on and build your business and make it more sustainable and more scalable. I think those are just some examples, Suresh. I think there are many examples over a period of time, course correction is a nature of our business. And at different points of time, we do have to evaluate, reevaluate, and figure out what more that we need to do, what we need to cut down, and what we need to change in terms of direction.
Okay, so ET Startup School aims to do precisely that, Mayank. This is supposed to be a school for entrepreneurs who want to sharpen their game, or for young professionals who want to turn into entrepreneurs. And this is all for free. So hopefully we have no customer acquisition cost whatsoever. Okay, let's get back to you. Your last CEO, Arjun Mohan, quit after a 3-year stint at Upgrade. Did this affect employee morale?
No, I think when he moved out of Upgrade, Arjun was very clear why he wanted to move out. It was not a sudden decision from his side. It was a thought-through decision, and a decision which both of us had debated. So how do I know it hit the employee morale or not? I think for me, the metrics are attrition rates. For me, the metric are revenue growth and revenue growth projections, and then whether we are sort of meeting or we are on track or not. For me, the metric as a CEO is customer acquisition cost. Are we on track or not? So for us, on those metrics, we did not see any major change. Some metrics improved, some metrics remain as it is. So I think for us, while Arjun added a lot of strong inputs into building the business and taking it from ground A to ground B, we're very clear that why he wanted to move out and what was the rationale. And as long as I believe, as long as there's full transparency in the organization, and that's one of the sort of critical component of building trust and building a culture, the disruption you can minimize. But as a founder, if you try to hide things, hold things back, and are not very clear and not very articulate and not very sort of upfront about the topic, you do see an impact in either attrition rates or either in the employee cost going up or the marketing cost, the revenue impact, etc.
Mike, you recently laid off about 30% of the workforce in your subsidiaries, Harappa and Impartus. What was the thinking behind these layoffs? What was the course correction needed there?
No, so those just to add, once we acquire and once we do an M&A, there are multiple functions that gets created in, and there are different sort of duplication of functions that happen. While there was a recalibration of the employee distribution, that number would be not more than 0.5 or 1% of the overall Upgrade employee strength. And that typically happens, Suresh, when you acquire about 10, 15 companies, you have same number of people doing same jobs across different organizations. And therefore, ensuring that you bring in the right, and you avoid duplication of work, you avoid the redoing of the same things at different locations and different places, it helps you to sort of bring efficiency into the system. So while on a smaller denominator, it may look like a larger percentage, but an aggregate level, it was hardly a change in the overall sort of team size and team strength. In fact, we were net higher despite some of these things, because those are some calls that you need to take, because in certain businesses there may be things that are getting repeated and getting duplicated. So that was a broader sort of thought process in some of the course corrections that we have taken in some of the subsidiaries.
Okay, startups may have to do layoffs at some point of time. So Mayank, in your view, what is the best way to do layoffs? Some people say do it gently, slowly, tell people what's coming. Some others say it's like getting a root canal. It's better to do it swiftly, just walk in one day. It's an unpleasant task, just do it quickly. What is your personal view on how to do a layoff?
See, my take is the twofold. One is that I don't think there's a right or wrong approach between the two. I do believe that transparency in communication is the foundation stone of any decision that you take in an organization, whether it is laying off or changing the course of your business. I think the first thing first, as every founder, one needs to be very clear and very articulate in all the decisions and what the organization is going through. Whether there's a duplication of function, whether the growth has come down and not as much as what it used to be, whether the marketing cost has gone beyond a certain threshold. It's important that you're communicating that on an ongoing and frequent basis across the organization via town halls, via sort of various messages, etc. But once you decide to take a decision, I'm of a school of thought that you take the decisions quickly and swiftly. Because if you have to take a decision, and this is my thought process, Suresh, that whenever I think of some decision making, I think about what is the final outcome that I want. And in reaching the final outcome, let's say one approach is, let's take time. Let's first let the message go in. Let's people absorb the message. Then let's do it for first 10%, some 20%, then 50% of the workforce that you're letting moving out. I think that's not the right approach to running it because you create massive uncertainty in the minds of your own colleagues. You're not clear about your decision. Because if you're clear about your decision that this is what you want to do, why take those steps? I personally believe that if you're clear about the decision, take the decision, live with the consequence. But in this entire thing, just hold on one thing very clear, that you are very transparent, very clear about your communication. See, at the end of the day, paths cross. And when the paths cross, you do want to sit down with that individual and have a beer or have a cup of coffee or have a chai. And you should not be afraid of having, and you should not shy away from meeting and sort of seeing the person eye to eye because you were dishonest. And that's the basic funda or mantra that at least I follow in some of the decision making that I do.
You've used the words honesty and transparency quite often in this interview so far, Mayank. Now, sometimes this can happen in a company. You said that the number of layoffs in Harappa and Impartus may be 1% of your workforce or less than 1%. Sometimes a company can both be downsizing, hiring, and acquiring new companies at the same time.
Yeah.
So the employee is saying, okay, why are you firing people if you're also buying other companies? Why couldn't you use that money to retain people? Now, there may be a logic to it, an industrial logic to what you're doing, but emotions are involved here. How do you communicate, especially when this sort of dichotomy is there in the business?
I think communicate. I think those are 1, 2, 3 steps that one needs to do as a founder. Because if you do not communicate and if you believe that your actions are communicating what you're suggesting and what you're saying, it just leaves a very bad taste in the mouth of your colleagues and your employees. Because at the end of the day, they are your colleagues. They are the ones who worked with you to build the business out and to take the organization from where it was to where it is right now. So if you're not being very clear about the decision-making, the rationale for the decision-making, I also believe personally, Suresh, that today's generation really understand and appreciate if you explain them the rationale for the decision-making. I agree that there are emotions involved, but people understand the rationale for that call. But if you are not very clear in explaining the rationale for what you are taking the decision for, it creates massive heartburns. So, I mean, as I said, that you have to go in with that approach that could I see eye to eye with that person and sit down and have a cup of coffee if I meet that person later in life? If you keep that mantra in mind, if you keep that sort of philosophy in mind, and if you explain the person why a decision is being done in the manner it is being done, yes, we may be a net hirer. We may have increased the headcount. Mm-hmm. But there were certain places where there were issues and we need to be very clear and upfront about it. And people do understand, appreciate that at the end of the day, you're taking a call for a sustainability of the business, sustainability of the organization. And the right calls have to be taken because a lot of those individuals also hold ESOPs of the company.
Yeah.
So for them, the value of that ESOP will grow only if the right decisions are being taken for the company best interest in mind, because that's what matters at the end of the day, because that's what will sort of ensure that you are building a sustainable organization.
Let's now talk about the so-called funding winter that is here. First of all, is it a so-called funding winter or is it real?
See, I don't know. I do see that after winter, summers do come. After winter, spring comes. Winter or no winter, I think these are good terminologies being used to accentuate what's really happening. But in all honesty, there is definitely sort of, there are pressure on interest rates, whether it is from Fed side or from the RBI side. There's definitely tightening of liquidity in the market. If there is a tightening of liquidity in the market, the decision, the cost of capital has of course changed. if the cost of capital has changed, the decision making of deploying that capital will of course change. So I think there's no, we don't need rocket science to sort of understand whether it's a winter or not, but there is going to be an impact of the decision that has happened during COVID time. Because during COVID, to ensure that the economy sustains and grows beyond a certain threshold, multiple governments had to print money, including the US, and therefore money was available at a much sort of better rate. US has seen low interest rate for a very, very long period of time, and low inflation rate for a very long period of time. So maybe it's time for them to move up and accept that inflation will remain high in the long run. But because of that, the central government, the Fed, or other places will have to sort of take some calls. So there are 2-3 things happening here, Suresh. One is a tightening on liquidity from the central banks. Two, the performance of some of the listed entities in the startup ecosystem that people have witnessed. And the third one is sort of essentially the net EBITDA that the ecosystem can generate. I think all three have been questioned and all three have sort of come in together at the same point of time. And therefore, you are seeing a lot more cautious approach from investors as to where to invest and who to invest and who to back at the end of the day. Having said that, I do believe that there are the 10th percentile and there are the 90th percentile of the organization that exist out there. The top ones will continue to attract capital. The top ones will continue to get access to capital, access to opening up of new markets. And you will see even today, I mean, last 2-3 days, you can open up the news articles. You will find companies that are raising money, raising capital. But is the market cautious? 100% it is cautious. Is the market open for the right sort of company? It is definitely open for the right sort of companies. There are certain fundamental shifts that will, because of access to capital very freely available, certain wrong decisions did end up getting taken in the ecosystem. Will those decisions get corrected? Yes, they will get corrected, and the right company will continue to attract the right kind of support and capital.
Mayank, what is a down round and what do founders need to know about it?
See, down rounds are typically what you raise the last round of valuation if today the ecosystem or the investor community or the set of investors who are coming and looking at you do not believe that you deserve that round, they may come and say, okay, you came in at $100 million of valuation. But today, I believe that you are at $70 or $80 million or $50 million in terms of your value. So I will only give you capital at a lower share price at which you raise the last round of equity funding. So that technically is a down round. Whatever that you raised at, and in the current context, the valuation comes down. It is an important concept in today's context because the investor ecosystem is questioning the valuation at which people raised capital at. Did they raise it at the right value? Do we still believe that you can go ahead and list yourself at a higher value than what you raised at? So given that, a lot of founders have to take a decision today, A, to raise or not to raise, B, to raise at the same value or a higher value or go even lower in terms of valuation. So fundamentally, a lot of founders today are discussing this topic very openly, whether we should raise capital, whether we should raise capital at a lower sort of valuation, and whether it will mean that even after raising a lower valuation, I can breach the valuation benchmark that I said earlier. And those decisions and those sort of conversations are very actively happening in the ecosystem right now.
Sometimes another kind of course correction that's required is, for instance, salary reductions. You may not want to lay off people, but you may want to cut salaries. Now, yeah. This is not going to make anybody happy, right? Because we all plan our lives based on a certain projected cash flow. And I've seen most employees say, you know, that one CEO, if they fired, or that one top manager, if they fired, none of us would have to take salary cuts. What's a good way to sell salary cuts to your organization if you have to?
No, I think salary cuts is a good sort of an important tool that at least we have seen within the organization, people taking that decision. That's a look. I mean, I don't want to let go of 100 of people, but we'll take a salary cut because that will ensure that the payroll cost comes to a certain sustainable level rather than remaining high. And that just makes the organization unit economics, organization P&L look far better. And maybe we hired at a certain level at a point of time when capital was easily available and one sort of ended up hiring people at a higher salary. And today we don't need to and we can replace that. So I think the pros of salary cuts is that you don't have to take a tough decision of letting go of a large number of people. You can tell them that, look, guys, I mean, I can't afford this kind of a salary. And therefore, if you take a 10%, 20%, 30% cut or 50% cut in your current salary level, I can still retain the role because the role currently justifies only this kind of salary structure. I think it's a good tool wherein you do not have to end up taking an extreme call of letting go of people, but ensuring that the job security is there. People are earning a certain amount of salary over a period of time. In fact, in certain conversations, when I was talking to some startup founders, where they said that, look, we're looking at doing a large cut in headcount. But when we went and spoke to our team members, they came back and said that, look, if you don't do a headcount reduction, we will ensure that we are taking a salary cut. And if that suffices the financial prudence that you're looking at, it's a win-win situation for both of them. So I think there are both sides to look at, whether it is, why a salary cut versus at least I have a job. And today I was just talking to somebody that in the last 6 months or so, about 500,000 jobs have been lost in the ecosystem today, as we speak, just in the Indian context. And these are reported numbers. I'm assuming that unreported numbers could be even higher. So for many people, it is better to be at a lower salary base than to be at a zero salary base, so that they can build on the equity. And if the founders feel that, look, these guys took that pain over a period of time, they will get rewarded in some manner at a later stage, is something that a lot of founders are using as a tool for going through this time that we are currently in right now.
Mayank, I once worked in a startup, and not in a tech startup, but a radio startup. And at the end of the year, when we said, can we get a raise? They said, no, the company hasn't made money, so we can't give you raises. Now, this is a tough thing to sell because inflation is inflation. My cost of living is real and my aspirations are also real. And I ask you this because media reports say that Upgrad's losses went up 3x to 626 crores in FY22. What will it take for you to turn this around and become a consistently profitable company?
Yeah, I think that increments need not necessarily be linked to the losses. So I think as an organization, we are giving increments and we will be making increments. I think a lot of companies have decided.
Can we separate it?
Yeah.
And increments and profit and loss.
Correct. So I think from a profit and loss sort of context, the way you have to see the business, Suresh, is that there are certain businesses that exist, and specifically, let's say, the current startup ecosystem. These businesses exist at to make money at a certain scale. So there's an investment that is needed. So in today's context, compared to, let's say, the previous era, the oil refineries or the larger factories were being built, all the large expenses were written down as capex. So in the EBITDA P&L pool, you would never see a term called EBITDA loss and the company would make money. In today's context, when you're building tech startup, a lot of cost are getting covered in P&L itself. So building the tech platform, building a brand presence, creating an investment to sort of build the right kind of delivery infrastructure, delivery capabilities. These are all capex in the older era, but today none of us sort of put it as capex, but we put it up as P&L item. So therefore it comes up in the P&L as EBITDA loss. And all of us are aware that, look, beyond a certain threshold scale, that EBITDA percentage of loss, let's say if it's minus 100 or minus 50%, over a period of years, keep on coming down. And that's what sort of a lot of companies work with. But the key thing to keep in mind, and when you're looking at P&L ecosystem, is what is the contribution margin and what is the gross margin that you're operating at? And as you're scaling up, do you need to add more fixed cost to cover up that increased scale up? And that's where a lot of companies have to keep a very close eye on contribution margin or gross margin, that for every person that are coming on board in the organization, is that person profitable or not? Every customer coming in, that
would that be the definition of contribution margin? Every new employee or customer, what are they contributing to the bottom line?
Yes, correct. So I think the way we look at gross margin is for every customer coming in, what is the direct cost that you have to sort of pay? Contribution margin is to get to that customer, how much was the sales and marketing cost that you needed to sort of deploy? So if you take all the direct cost and all the acquisition cost, it gives you the contribution margin. So if you're every customer, so there are two types of businesses. One type of business says that, look, every customer coming in should be profitable to me. And that would mean that I don't lose money in getting a new customer into the system. There's another school of business that exists, Suresh, where they say, I'm willing to spend a lot more to acquire a customer because I know that the customer will stay with me for the period of next 6 months, 1 year, 5 years, 10 years time duration. So I will recover the money over a period of time. So then they look for, okay, if my customer acquisition cost is X and the lifetime value of the gross margin is Y, does that make sense for me to recover Y amount if the person, if the customer stays with me for 6 months, 8 months, 1 year, 5 year, 10 year period to justify the investment of X? And that's what typically is called the LTV to CAC ratio, which is lifetime value to CAC ratio. And
customer acquisition cost.
Yeah. So some places people look for a lifetime value to customer acquisition cost ratio of 3:1 and should be above 2:1. In certain businesses where there's no concept of lifetime value, it's a one-time purchase, then individual look for, okay, that one-time purchase should be profitable even on the first purchase. And we are not hoping and living in the hope that tomorrow the money will come back to me. So I think both schools of businesses exist. And today, different businesses are taking different level of calls to come to becoming profitable at the earliest, I mean, with the right path that they are taking at this point in time.
Okay, Mayank, we've spoken about laying off people. We've spoken about salary cuts. We've spoken about course corrections. What we haven't spoken about, how does a founder know when it's time to shut a business? When you have to take the hard call, what's done is done. I need to shut.
So there are two things, Suresh. I think when you're looking at a P&L or a cash flow statement or a running a business, sometimes you end up saying that, look, I'm not able to scale up or my losses are at a certain level. At that point of time, as a founder, there are two, three decisions that you have in front of you. So there can be two, three scenarios with that decision. So let's say the decision is, let me cut certain investments. And two things can happen if I cut those investments. The first thing that can happen is my businesses will scale down, but it will be at a sustainable level. So you cut certain burn to scale down the growth, to scale down the business level. So you are 100, you can come to 90, but you have cut down the business and you are in a much better profitable or a sustainable ecosystem. The second line of business situations are that where you say, if I cut down the burn, I will lose the business. So there are certain businesses that fall in category one. You cut down burn, you slow down the business growth, and you slow down or you come to a sustainable level and you continue. If you cut down burn, you will not even have a business available.
Give us examples of a simple example of each of these types of businesses.
So let's say there's one case in which you are investing certain amount of money in marketing or growth, and you say, I'm getting 100 rupees I'm putting in, I get 200 in terms of my revenue from the customer or whatever. Let's say that's an example. If you pay, and let's say you are operating at a gross margin of 50%.
Yeah.
So for every 200 rupees, you get 100 into your books.
Yeah.
But if you're spending 100 rupees to acquire the customer, that customer in itself is not making any money.
Right.
So there's no reason for you to acquire the customer. And you say, okay, fine, I'll spend 80 rupees. So instead of acquiring 200 revenue, I will acquire 190, and 190 will give me about 95 rupees of gross margin. So I'm spending 80 rupees to get 95 rupees of revenue. So I'm still making some money.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a scenario where you are reducing your revenue
by
reducing your investment. But you are in a better position because earlier you were making zero money. Now today you're making 15 rupees every customer coming in. In the second scenario, let's say you are putting in 100 and you get 200 revenue and it's 50% gross margin. You come in, you bring it down, and sort of it does not sustain yourself. But if you make it 80, you don't get to 190 in terms of revenue. You get to 160 in terms of revenue. And then when you get to 50, instead of coming to 160 in terms of revenue, you get to 100 in terms of revenue. So every time that you're cutting the revenue, you are letting go of acquisition channel, which in itself was not sustainable. So every cut of the acquisition channel is taking you to the same situation where you don't make any money. So you keep on cutting down your spend, and you're left with no business at all. So as a founder, you need to be very clear about, is your business on cutting burn lead you to being at a sustainable level in a better position, or cutting burn will make your business even at the same level or make it even worse? So it might as well shut the business down. So as a founder, that's the call and that's the thing that one should look for. That are you at a place where cutting down of spends will mean lowering of business and lowering of revenue, but sustainable, or cutting down your spends would mean shutting down the business because there's no business that is left to be run. And that's the dichotomy or that's the dilemma that a lot of founders are currently sort of at right now.
What's a clear sign that I should shut my business? A clear, crystal clear sign.
You cut down your burn, you cut down your investment, nothing happens to your burn. If you're in that situation, that even cutting down the business, cutting down the revenue and nothing happens to burn, it means that you need to shut down the business then and there itself, because you are actually putting bad money behind good money. And no matter how much money you sort of invest or how much money you cut down, you are at a zero-sum business line at the end of the day.
I want you to wear your VC hat when you answer this. Some companies have successfully, under pressure, course-corrected from a B2C, for instance, to a B2B model and turned it around and been successful. What's the secret to this sort of painful but successful transition?
B2C businesses are definitely more cash-guzzling in nature. And I have a running joke, Suresh, that for every edtech company that has pivoted from B2C to B2B, if you charge a dollar, you will be a millionaire today.
That's a good business model. I'll just charge a dollar for every company that's pivoted.
So B2B has an inherent advantage. Your customer acquisition cost is limited. Your average value size and ticket size is pretty high. You have more predictable nature of business. And I can talk about just in edtech and education. B2B adds a lot of predictability. It comes at a higher gross margin. It comes at a much higher contribution margin. It may not scale in the same manner in which a B2C business is scale, may scale slower, but will add to the EBITDA pool much more than a B2C line of business. Because B2C line of business inherently is about making a market, convincing a consumer and reaching out to those consumers who are very, very fragmented is very expensive proposition. But reaching out to corporates who are not as fragmented as consumers is a much sort of cheaper sort of play. So I think therefore a lot of companies do end up taking that call. Look, I have a great product. I'm solving for a customer need. But for me to acquire that customer is a very, very expensive proposition. So let me go to a place where I can get the same consumer or same customer or same consumer, but in a more aggregated manner. And therefore you see people, companies sort of moving from B2C to B2B route. Because there are fewer companies, less fragmentation, easy to reach out, higher gross margin, higher contribution margin, much better revenue predictability than a B2B, than a B2C line of business. And those are the inherent reasons why companies shift to B2B and pivot to B2B. And once you're in that domain and you're in that zone, a lot of decision making become much more easier for the founders to take because you have to manage one company with 10,000 employees versus managing 10,000 customers. On an individual basis.
Penultimate question. What if the founder is the source of trouble at the company? Recent examples would be Uber, maybe BharatPay, a few years ago, housing.com, where the founders ran afoul of their investors, founders ran afoul of their board members. Does the VC step in and just take the company away from you? Is that?
Yeah, I think it's a fiduciary responsibility of all the board members at that point of time. I think there's a reason why board exists. I don't think investors need to come in if they're part of the board. But as a board of director, my fiduciary responsibility is to ensure that the company is sustainable and the company is solvent. And if there are any ethical malpractice happening in the organization, then the board has to step in and take the right calls. Look, there will always be that issue. Founders will always say that, look, what I was doing was the right thing for the organization. And maybe the board may decide to have a difference of opinion. I don't think one or the other is right or wrong. But in some of these scenarios, I believe it is absolutely the fiduciary responsibility of the board, because you are running a business on certain else's money. And as a board, as an organization, you are responsible and answerable to that investor who is putting that money. Now, if the board feels and decides that, look, this organization is not run in the right manner, and sometimes it does happen, look, founders have come with a very strong mindset, very strong point of view, that they tend to come out very strongly with the investor and the board. But at the end of the day, you set up a board with some investors, founders, and certain independent members. And at that point of time, the board is comprised people, or come with sort of set of people who come from diverse background who have seen businesses, and it's their responsibility and the right sort of, I think it's just the responsibility, nothing else. I mean, you're not even asking them to go and take an extra work, etc., because their job is to ensure that the organization remains solvent and sustainable. And ego should not come on the way of building businesses out. And I believe at that point in time, I don't expect a VC to step in. Yes, a VC should step in as an investor. But the board should come up and take a decision to ensure that the business remains solvent, because it's not your money that you are playing with or running with. It's somebody else's money that you have to bring back. And that just reminds me one more point, Suresh, that many a times when you raise money, you get your WhatsApp message which says, congratulations. I always say that, look, don't congratulate somebody. Just say all the best.
Yeah.
Because any money that you take sits on the liability.
It's not an asset.
Correct. Yeah, it's not an asset.
People keep thinking that raising money is an asset. It's actually a liability.
Yeah, it's a liability. You have to pay it back at some point of time.
You have to pay dearly for it.
Okay. Correct.
Mayank Kumar, final question for you. We had 2.5 to 3 years of lockdown. One personal course correction that you did during the lockdown in your personal life?
I invested heavily on my health. See, running a business, Suresh, is also, it's a marathon, right? It's not a sprint. And when you are a marathon runner, you understand that each and every step counts, and you have to come for the marathon with a fresh mindset every marathon. So I believe that for me to build a long-term business, it's equally important that I'm mentally very strong. And if I have to be mentally very strong, I need to be physically very strong. And that's the thing that I decided to do. And I course-corrected myself. I shed some kilos. I took some habits which are going to stay with me for the rest of my life.
Mayank Kumar, co-founder of Upgrad, thank you very much for being part of ET Startup School.
Thanks, Suresh. Thank you very much for having me today.
So that brings us to almost the end of today's class at ET Startup School. If you'd like to be a good student, check out and do the homework assignment in the show notes. If you like the podcast, share it with family, friends, even your frenemies. ET Startup School is produced by Animesh Das, with inputs from Anupriya Nair, Erika D'Souza, Arijit Burman, Shilpa Sharma, Harish Shavla, Govind Mundra, and Vishal Bhandari. ET Startup School is available on economictimes.com and ET Play, as well as Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, JioSaavn, and Google Podcasts.